are just joining us. This is Jean Ballant with the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'm here to help moderate a seminar that's been sponsored by Cluin. Today's seminar will look at practical models to support remediation strategy decision-making, and it's part four of a five-part seminar series that's been hosted on Cluin throughout the months of September, October, and then we'll lead into November as we conclude the series. We have begun our live audio broadcast coming right up at our scheduled start time of 1 p.m. Eastern. I'm going to go ahead and cover a couple of reminder items before we begin the technical portion of today's broadcast. As I mentioned, when we open up the lines today, our entire seminar is being broadcast through a new tool, Adobe Connect. We do appreciate everyone who both gives us their patience as we test out this new tool, and it's helped us by providing a lot of feedback and comments as we test out some of the new features offered through the service. The entire session will be delivered through Adobe Connect, and all of our participants will be able to both listen as well as watch the presenters give their presentations from various geographic locations in real time. In fact, we'll even be able to watch some of our presenters run live simulations of computer models today. The materials have been made available in advance from the seminar homepage. So if you've downloaded a copy of the presentation slides and are simply following along manually on the phone, you'll be able to pay attention to a portion of it, but some of the live broadcasts simply won't be captured in that way. So we do encourage you to let us know if you're having problems with Adobe Connect so we can continue to improve and help troubleshoot whatever issues might have so you can join us for the live broadcast in Adobe. By default, all audio is streamed online in the Adobe Connect meeting environment. So everyone who's participating today should be able to hear me through their computer or mobile device. And if we'll just bear with me, it looks like we've lost the slide deck. I'm going to pull that right back up again. Just remind everybody that I'm going through some housekeeping items. And then I'll continue on. Again, that audio is coming through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems with the audio, I would encourage you to check locally first with your volume or speakers. Make sure they're maximized or adjusted properly. Some participants have found that by using headphones, it helps improve the audio sound or quality. Those of you who are listening on telephone lines, though, you've been globally muted, and I'd ask that you remain on mute until we get to the points for Q&A with our presenters. At that time, I'll remind you how you can go off of mute, but again, I would encourage you to remain muted. If you have any difficulties with the online audio broadcast, feel free to report those problems using the Q&A pod that appears in the lower right corner. We do have a limited number of telephone lines that we may be able to make available to those of you who require it. If you're having any other issues with the audio, feel free to take a look in the upper left corner of the Adobe Connect room. You'll see a green speaker icon. Again, if it's shaded bright green, that means it's turned on. You can try clicking that on and off, or again, following the instructions or icons that appear to the right of that that will allow you to manually adjust the audio within the Adobe Connect room. We will take breaks for Q&A with our presenters at a number of portions, segments throughout today's session. And at that time, those of you on the phone lines will be able to come off of mute to ask a question out loud. Those of you who are listening to the audio online, though, can again use that Q&A pod that appears in the lower right corner to type up your comments or questions. And in fact, I would encourage you to go ahead and submit them now. There's no need to wait. If you have questions that were left over from last week's seminar, we'll have a break to try to address some of those. And again, you can feel free to copy and paste any other questions or comments that may be on your mind. And when we get to those designated breaks for Q&A, I'll read them out loud on your behalf to the presenters so that they may be addressed them. Today's seminar is being recorded, just like all of the others in the series, and it usually takes us a few days to get them posted. So everyone who signed up for today's seminar will automatically receive an email as soon as that free archive is available for free replay and download. Again, the entire collection of the seminar, as well as almost 500 other seminars that have been hosted on Cluin, are currently available on the Cluin archive on the URL shown on slide number two. Apologize, I have a little problem here with my voice. Just a quick screenshot on slide number three, which is showing the new interface that we're using through Adobe Connect. As I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of the screen should be occupied by the slides or live screen demonstrations that our presenters will be given. If you're having problems with your online audio, I draw your attention to the upper left corner where you should see a green speaker icon. You can actually click that to turn it on and off, or click the little arrow pointing next to it that will allow you to actually pull up a set of volume or audio controls. If you'd like to submit questions or comments, you can do that using the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner. Some of these windows may change or resize as we move throughout the broadcast, but this is the general layout. You can simply type your question or comment here, click the button, and it'll privately be submitted to myself so that I can either respond to you directly or read it out loud when we get to those designated Q&A breaks. Well, another thing that I want to be sure to draw everybody's attention to is that full screen button. During the live demonstrations, we've had a couple people comment that they're not able to view the software that's being shown, or they're having problems reading the screen. Each individual participant does have a full screen button that appears on the top of the larger share window when content's being displayed. It's a toggle switch, so you can click that full screen button on and off to actually increase and blow up the slides to full screen, or click it again to turn that off and bring you back into the main Adobe Connect environment. So when we get to the live software demonstration, I would encourage you to click that full screen button. We've tested a number of configurations, and unfortunately, we can't make the software look any larger to you from the presenter's desktop. So the full screen button is going to be the best shot you have at making things look better. If the full screen button isn't good enough, just to the right of it, there are two square boxes. The rightmost box is a zoom in feature. So if you go to full screen and then you click that rightmost box that will allow you to zoom in even further, that should hopefully blow it up as large as we can to give you the option to read the font as clearly as possible. If you continue to have problems, please feel free to use that Q&A pod to report those issues and let me know. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for everybody today. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our presenters. Brian, feel free to take it away.
Hi, this is Brian Looney. I'm going to get the slide deck up here. I'd first like to gratefully acknowledge, our team would like to gratefully acknowledge the organizations and individuals who've sponsored the development of both the content, the models and information we're presenting, and the delivery of the workshop. And I'm going to go in kind of reverse order, the Department of Energy Office of Soil and Groundwater Cleanup, and then importantly, the U.S. Department of Defense Strategic Environmental Research and Development, and the Environmental Security and Technology Certification Programs, that's CERTIP and ESTCP. And then most importantly is the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the CERCLA Education Center, the ORD Superfund and Technology Liaison Program, and the Office of Underground Storage Tanks. And I see that they're on the line, so specifically also Kira Lynch and Queenie Munjan Davis for their support. I know that many of you, or some of you, may have been impacted by the hurricane, and we really appreciate anyone who's on the line from the East Coast. Hopefully you're all right, and we appreciate you taking the effort to be on. If you're in the East Coast and have been impacted and are listening to this on the archive, we appreciate you taking the time to come onto the archive and listen and keep up with things, and hope that all the recovery efforts are going well, because everyone in the country, our hearts are going out to you, and we hope things are great for you. It's our goal in this course to encourage creative, thoughtful, technically based decision making. That's the whole basis of the course, and we built the course around a series of questions that people run into as they're trying to make decisions associated with waste sites. You know, how much cleanup is needed? Do I need both source and plume cleanup? How do I combine remedies? Things like that. And there's a wide range of tools to support that decision making, and those tools range from very simple hand calculations all the way up to more complex and flexible numerical models. And as I've said in the previous interactions, we think that based on surveys that a lot of folks are using these kind of intermediate level tools and practical tools, and they can be particularly useful and valuable because they're easy and quick to run. But they're not going to be the tools that you would use for everything. We particularly like RemChlor and RemFuel, recent tools that EPA has sponsored the development of along with the Department of Defense, and because they are set up in a way to both encourage asking questions about strategic remediation decisions and allow you to run lots of cases quickly. For sites that are more complex, you can think of RemChlor and RemFuel as being screening tools that get you going in maybe a good direction and then follow up with numerical models. And for a lot of sites, these tools may work by themselves. So just quickly, the primary deliverers of this workshop are Ron Falta. He's a professor at Clemson University. instructor for subsurface remediation modeling and hydrogeology. Importantly, he developed both REMCLOR and REMFUEL, the principal technical developments for those, in collaboration with EPA ADA Lab personnel. He also has written like T2VOC and some other fairly high-end numerical models. So he's one of the premier kind of resources for modeling in the country. We also have Chuck Newell from Groundwater Services in Houston. He's a co-author of two books and five various decision support software systems, a large number of technical articles, and is in essence a national resource for assembling and organizing and summarizing the state of knowledge for environmental cleanup. So it's an honor to have those two guys as principals. And then the rest of the team includes Karen Vangelis, who is a project manager here at Savannah River National Laboratory. Myself, I was the technical coordinator for developing the materials in the class. And Shala Farhat, who has developed a wide range of practical tools. She works with Chuck at Groundwater Services in Houston. So we're located throughout the country, as Gene said, and we know the infrastructure is a little bit fragile today, so if something happens, someone else will either jump in and start running the model. Just as a review and a preview, the first three sessions, we introduced the philosophy of the modeling and some of the underpinning mathematics. We'll go into that a little more detail today, but we also looked at cases of, what happens if I do nothing? What is kind of, would you use a model like this to look at natural attenuation? What happens if I do source remediation? How do you enter that into the model? And for today, what we're going to do is we're going to take a case and we're going to review those things. We're going to redo those for this case. But we're also going to then begin this process of, for sites that are more complex, how do you combine source and plume remediation in the model and explore options and explore how much remediation, what types of remediation might be most useful. We're going to continue that next week, and that is really one of the most interesting when we've interacted with folks on REMCLOR and REMFUEL. The final part of the interaction has always been most interesting, and it has been very dynamic with lots of back and forth and discussion in the room. When we do this in the room, we break into groups and the groups all solve problems and kind of report back out. So what we're doing is we're trying to figure out a way to make that same kind of dynamic and interest and excitement for the online. So we're going to, I guess in the spirit of the season, put out some polls and surveys, and we'll have lots of voting that goes on next week in the workshop, so that we can kind of get your opinions and feelings on things, because what we want to explore is how do we best and most technically and rationally strategize and develop remediations, and we'll build it around the same case that we're working on today. So that's really the kind of review and preview, and that's where we are. And I think there were some open questions left from last week, Gene, that we wanted to maybe go through and do some quick answers on today.
That is correct. So I'm going to go ahead and start with some of the questions we had left over from last week. If you have other questions and you'd like to submit them, feel free to go ahead and use that Q&A pod that appears in the lower right corner to type them up. I'm going to start with the first question that comes in from Sydney, who states that, as I understand the model, it seems to deal primarily with groundwater flow and contaminant flow in porous media. Where I work, most of the cases I deal with have uppermost aquifers, which are located within bedrock. Here, secondary porosity such as fracture flow is often dominant. How well do REMCLOR and REMFUEL models work in bedrock aquifers where secondary porosity is dominant? Has anybody worked with these models in such situations?
Go ahead, Chuck.
This is Chuck from GSI Environmental. I was just briefly going to say this is all about these representative elemental volumes, and if your fractured system is dense enough that the flow will respond with Darcy's law, then you can apply these. However, if it's not, if it's more like a karst, where Darcy's law doesn't apply, then put REMCLOR and put REMFUEL away.
Right. This is Brian. I was going to say the same kind of thing. And of course, if you're working in these aquifers, you are well aware of the cautions. But if an equivalent, if you can treat your system as an equivalent porous media, you can use models like this. If not, you don't. You can't really, and then you have to go to something more complex. And I know Ron has worked on this as well as others, but you know, dual domain and a whole wide range of tools that are available. But the simple tools really break down when you have conditions that are widely outside of the assumed conditions.
And I would add that if the matrix diffusion is an important part of the problem, the plume models in RemCore and RemFuel don't account for that. So you would need a transport code that can have the interaction between the fracture and the matrix.
Okay, great. Our next question came in from Rebecca, who stated, with old releases, we don't really know how much product was lost. Can you speak on how to deal with this unknown and how to put, Can you speak on how to deal with this unknown and how to input an unknown parameter into RemCore or RemFuel?
Well, there's a couple ways to do it. The simplest way is to run it with different values and see what happens. We also have the probabilistic version of RemCore called PRemCore that kind of automates that process, and you can get that from if you send an email to me. So there's no simple answer, though, except to look at a reasonable range and see what the outcome is.
Okay. Our next question comes in, and it says that the equation that describes the actual question is C over C O or C naught equals to M over M naught raised to the K. And they're asking if that's the actual equation.
I think that's the gamma equation, and I think Greek symbol didn't come through. So that's the equation that describes the relationship between mass removal and the concentration being leached or output from the source. And I don't understand specifically the question beyond that.
Okay.
But this is also called the power law or the power function, but that's it, where that exponent is this gamma, and that's this dial that can be used to relate concentration to mass at any time.
Okay, great. And just as a note to all of our participants, if you hear your question asked and it looks like we need more information, feel free to go ahead and submit some supplemental information and we'll get it back in the queue. Our next question comes in asking for sigma V, it is the pore velocity standard deviation divided by the mean pore velocity. How do you obtain the pore velocity standard deviation?
Well, that's the method that we get dispersion into the model by varying the stream tube velocities, and that produces a scale-dependent longitudinal dispersion. It's exactly scale-dependent, linearly scale-dependent. So there's a chart in the RemClor manual, and I believe also in the RemFuel manual, that relates that sigma V value to the scale-dependent dispersivity. So you can relate it to a dispersivity, but ultimately, I think it's a calibration parameter.
And this is Brian. The other thing that there are references where you can look up the range of dispersivity values, things like the appendices in the BioClor manual, places like that. And so it's a two-step process. You would look up a reference like that. You would kind of figure out the range of dispersivities that you want to use, then go to the RemClor manual and use the table to convert that to the sigma V.
And this is Chuck. I think I've actually got four steps to this, and Brian, Ron, tell me if there's a better way to say it, but if I were actually going to do this at a site, I would determine what plume length, how long the plume has gone. I've got that plume length in meters or in feet. Then second, I would pick an alpha X value, and for me, I would go to something like the BioClor manual or some other source that has these different relationships between plume length and alpha X. And BioClor manual is one place to do that. Just over the past couple of years, the idea is maybe do smaller alpha X's than maybe we would have 10 years ago. Step three is then take this plume length and then divide it by the alpha X, and then go to page 41 on the RemClor manual and just look up the value, and then you type that directly into the into RemFuel RemClor.
Okay, yep. Great. Do you have more on that?
This is Brian. I was just going to say, Chuck's comment on tending to use smaller dispersivities, that's actually true from a theoretical perspective if you're implementing models where you are discretizing at a very fine scale. Recognizing that what you're doing in a simplified model like RemClore is you're accounting for changes in flow that occur over seasons and even years and decades, that is probably not something you would necessarily do with RemClore. The key with RemClore is both gamma and these sigmas or dispersivities are intended to capture some of the detail that is difficult or complicated, would be expensive to get data for, or you don't even have data for, in terms of plume architecture or source architecture. And so what you're trying to do in RemClore is match the gross behavior of the plume and then look at the impacts of that behavior as you take all these different hypothetical source and plume remediation actions. So I guess to me the take-home message is don't make too big of a deal out of the selection. Try to get in the middle of some of these references for ranges of values, and if you know you have a particular condition or another, you then bias toward one end or the other.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question comes in regarding RemFuel. And Craig asks us, since you are considering, quote, initial data, does a release happening over decades factor in?
Well, this is Chuck. I'll start that. And with one consideration is that if you're interested in calibrating a plume length and if your plume is still expanding, it's important to put that release or your mass at the start date of the release, not in the middle or not at the end, if your release happens over 10 years, because you want to make sure that the model can get the plume to be long enough. For RemFuel, this is less important because most of these constituents attenuate pretty rapidly and these plumes tend to stabilize pretty quick. Brian, Ron, anything you guys want to add to that?
Yeah, this is Brian. If it's really important, you could always superimpose these in a spreadsheet by running the model several times with different release dates, but that's kind of tedious and tricky to do by hand, but it can be done sort of mathematically at least.
Right, and if it's an overarching issue, once again, you can always upgrade to a numerical model where you can put it in explicitly.
Okay. Our next question basically asks if RemFuel has been validated using actual data from LUST sites.
And that's Well, this is Chuck. Let me just start out here.
Storage tanks, sorry.
Okay. So I'll go ahead and start out with just some thoughts. And there's a real interesting 1992 paper by Konikow and Breedehoff entitled, and this is just really, I think I know the concept of the question, but here's just talking about some of the terminology. But their paper said groundwater models cannot be validated. And you can get this paper on the web. Send me an email. I can show you where the link is. But it's pretty interesting. They say that because of the uncertainties down there and the way these models are set up, this idea that you can validate something, we just got to think about these models in different ways. Now, that being said, I think the plume piece of RemFuel and RemClore, based on this Domenico equation, have been history matched pretty successfully. History match is this alternate term for validate that Konikow and Breedehoff used. There's been some other papers sort of quibbling about some of the source terms with Domenico, more accurate ways of doing it. I don't think those are that important for this. So the Domenico plume model has had successful history matching. The gamma function in the source model, I think that there's been a lot of looking at these source concentration versus time curves and applying the first order decay. It's not really, I don't know if there's any history matching where it's been, you've applied a gamma 0.5 or gamma 2 to do the history matching, but that's just my experience. Any other comments from Ron or Brian?
Well, I agree with everything you said, and the RemFuel model was applied to a case in the user's guide at Port Hueneme to the MTBE plume. But again, that's a history match, so it's able to match the history through calibration. Now, whether it can predict the future, I mean, that's the true test, and we don't know that from that particular simulation. But like Chuck said, the plume model in these have been compared to other solutions, so that we feel like they're mathematically correct. You know, they have different assumptions. If those assumptions match up well with what's happening at a site, then it's likely to work well. But I'm a little skeptical about saying that, you know, you match one site, that means the model's valid. So it's kind of a nebulous term.
Gene, we just had a couple of people comment and ask, specifically one user would like to know if you can re-explain, quote, that models cannot be validated. That is the whole point, that the prediction needs to be tested. So they're looking for a little bit more of a re-explanation.
Well, this is Chuck. I think the paper that these guys wrote in 92 is a good way. The abstract just says that these models are embodiments of scientific hypotheses. They cannot be proven or validated, but only tested and invalidated. And they say, although models are definitely valuable tools for analyzing groundwater systems, their predictive accuracy may be limited. Validation and verification are misleading, and their use in groundwater science should be abandoned in favor of more meaningful model assessment descriptors. So I think it's a pretty useful sort of way to think about what these models can and can't do. 1992 paper in Advances in Water Resources.
And so this is Brian. So this is why this is actually, I think, potentially a useful workshop, because there's a lot of diversity on the panel and there's not actually full agreement. I kind of agree with the questioner that, I think it's wrong to quibble about semantics, about the word validation. The point being that the goal is to show that the models perform reasonably well and reasonably well-matched data. And I think there has been a lot of that done on the Domenico solution in particular, which is embodied in this model. REM fuel is fairly recent. So in a very specific answer to the question, there hasn't been a lot of time for the model to be applied to a lot of specific leaking underground storage tank sites. REM chlor has been around longer and probably has received a little bit more use, but both of them are fairly recent. So I think that the whole concept is for this workshop to kind of roll this out to as broad of group as possible. And I think that the verification, validation, and whatever terminology we want to use will be occurring over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think it's probably true that any time a new modeling tool comes out, it's probably 5 or 10 years before there's, in essence, kind of a full kind of community acceptance of what its strengths and limitations are. I think that's probably true with BioChlor and the things which are received so much use up until recently. Don't you think so, Chuck?
I think so. It is this matter of semantics, and this is where, you know, Konica and Breedehoff, you know, two big names in the groundwater modeling world, we're saying we're just using the wrong term for this, and we should use model testing, model valuation, model calibration, benchmarking, history matching, or parameter estimation.
Yeah, I don't think we should let Konica and Breedehoff like get us off on a semantic side, though.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay, great. Let's go ahead and try to take the next 2 minutes and get through a few more questions before we carry on with the presentation today. The next question, actually I have two of them that are somewhat similar, and people are asking, who do we send an email to if we want copies of PremClor, or how does one find the source decay program?
Well, for the PremClor, send an email to Ron, and I'll have Hylion, who actually did that work, send you the files. And then source decay is available from GSI Environmental from their webpage.
GSI-net.com.
And that's a good question, and we are going to have links on in Module 5 to source decay and all of the information on how to obtain not only source decay but a range of other practical tools as well.
Okay. Our next question comes in and asks about metal contamination. Is there a good modeling program we can use for screening? It seems pretty timely given some comments people made in the last session about metals.
Yeah, this is Brian. I think that's a good question. I don't think there's explicitly anything like REMClor and REMFuel or BioChlor available for metals. I think that there have been some fairly recent, pretty interesting advances, and some of those are the guidance documents that have been coming out on attenuation of metals and radionuclides that EPA ADA has developed. And there's a upfront section that's general, and then there are appendices for like element by element appendices, which provide a lot of information. Unfortunately, that requires you to kind of conceptualize things on an element-by-element basis. There is a scenarios document was developed with the input from ITRC and EPA by a team that DOE funded, where they try to put things into trends so that you can look at three or four or five or six elements together. But it's semi-quantitative, it's qualitative information. So I would say I'm not aware of anything in the kind of middle practical model sense that is in the same ilk as REMCOR right now, but there's a lot of progress being made in that area.
Yeah, and I'll just add, if you want to go more complex in terms of the inorganics, you know, there's the different codes. FREAK-C is one. It can be used in a groundwater modeling type environment with the FAST code, P-H-A-S-T, and then P-H-T-3-D. But more sophisticated numerical type approaches, nothing like REMFUEL, REMCOR.
And then we use the Geochemist Workbench, which has a 1D transport built into it as well. But, you know, those are really nice, sophisticated geochemical codes and really not set up in the to easily answer some of these questions at this point in time.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question online, and this came in from Carl, who worked very diligently to get his question in, so I'm going to go ahead and read this one in full text. In answering the hard rock modeling question, matrix diffusion was noted as important information to know. How does that matrix diffusion differ from back diffusion in porous media, and should they be handled differently in this modeling?
Well, they would be about the same, really. It's a matter of degree, I guess, as to how severe the effect is. In something like a fractured sandstone, it may be completely dominated by the diffusion of mass into the matrix. In a heterogeneous sand and clay system, there may be some effect of diffusion into the clays, but it may not dominate the plume response. So it's really kind of a continuum, I guess, of how important that could be.
Okay, great. I think that's going to stop with our question break now for Module 3. We do have designated breaks for additional questions, though, later on. Again, if you've submitted your questions, don't worry. They are still in the queue, and we'll try to get to them in our next question break.
So what we're going to do now is work through a couple of exercises. We're going to start with a little analytical exercise, really a thought experiment that Ron has constructed, which really helped calibrate us and get us kind of scoped in on the size and scale of some of these problems. But as I said before, we've explored briefly source remediation, we've explored briefly natural attenuation, and we're to this question of, you know, should I combine source and plume remediation? And when you do that, you basically have to kind of scope out the problem, as Ron's going to do here in a second. And then you also then have to go through, if you're going to figure out if you need to combine, you have to go through and redo the attenuation for the problem at hand. And you have to look at the potential for different kinds of remediations. So basically, what we're going to do now is Ron's going to go through his thought experiment, and then we're going to introduce a problem, and we'll explore that problem from a variety of different angles through the rest of today, and we'll use the same problem next week as we try to ask questions about what would potentially be more useful, what are relevant performance metrics that are going to be responsive to the different phases of remediation. So with that, Ron, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay, so we're going to start off with what I think is the simplest possible analysis you can do of this problem, and I'll show you the mathematics behind that. And this is related to the first homework problem where we looked at a stabilized plume and then thought about what would happen if we reduced the source strength by a factor of 10. And what we found was that the contours switched by a factor of 10, but the plume length didn't change by 10. So if you think in terms of the one-to-one relationship between source mass and source discharge, then when we take out half the source, we get half the discharge, and we take out 90% of source, you know, we're left with 10% of the discharge. And to a first approximation, I think that's how it works. Now, in the plume, eventually that plume will stabilize to that new source strength, and it'll also be correspondingly weaker. So If it's a one-to-one, a gamma of one relationship, when we take out 90% of the source, we expect the plume to wind up having only 10% of the mass eventually. So the plume is much weaker, but it's not necessarily 90% shorter. In fact, it is not 90% shorter. It's a different relationship between how the contours move and what the mass in the plume is. So there's actually a way to model that with a very simple equation, and I'm going to kind of walk through how we get to that, starting from a complicated equation. So up at the top here, this is the full advection dispersion equation with reaction. We have the time-dependent concentration or retardation factor, the chemicals moving down gradient at the velocity of the water. There's dispersion in the longitudinal direction, transverse to the flow, and also vertically. And then there's first-order decay. So solving this equation is fairly involved, but we can simplify this by making a few assumptions. And I'm going to try to show what mathematicians do. When they want to really solve an equation, they start looking for terms they can throw away in the equation. So they make assumptions. So if we assume that things are not changing much with time, that means it's steady state. That means the variation of concentration with time is zero. So we can get rid of that derivative there. So we get a zero on the left-hand side of this equation. We have to keep the advective term because that's what's moving the contaminant down into the plume, through the plume. But what if we feel like the dispersion is not a key thing? Well, we could neglect these dispersion terms and assume that the chemical is just moving by advection. And then the last term, the degradation, well, we know that's important. So what we've done here is boiled this down to the two most important terms, the advection of the chemical with the groundwater and the decay in the groundwater. So that gives us this equation that's down below here, this one, and we could just rearrange that so we have the time derivative of the the derivative of concentration with respect to X is equal to this ratio of the first order decay coefficient in the plume to the pore velocity multiplied by the concentration. So that's one of these differential equations that we can just integrate and get a logarithmic solution. But we have to specify the condition on the concentration at the boundary. In other words, what's the concentration leaving the source? So we say the source is at X equals zero. We'll say the concentration there is a value of C0. So that's the source strength. So with that kind of source strength, the solution to this differential equation is this logarithmic relationship. And this is what we were looking for all along here with this derivation. So this is telling you that if you want to know the concentration at some location X, the concentration C, the relationship is that the log of C over the source concentration equal to this minus decay rate over the velocity times X. So we can rearrange this and we can solve for the concentration at any location X, or we could figure out the distance X where we have any concentration and so forth. So the way I want to use this then, and this was published in a paper a few years ago, we take that equation and solve for X. So this would be the distance at which we have a concentration of C. And what we want to look at now is the outer edge of a plume. So we'll let C be something like the MCL or maybe the detection limit. Whatever we want to define the plume by, then that's the concentration value that we would put in here. And the C0 is the concentration back at the source, and then we've talked about these other terms. So now what if we do some remediation? Well, when we do source remediation, we're changing that C0. And we're changing it depending how much we take out. We take out a fraction X, we're left with 1 minus X. So when we do some remediation, we're changing that C0 by this amount. So before remediation, we just have C0 down here. And then if we take out 90%, we'd have C0 times 0.1 in here. So you can build the remediation into this equation through this 1 minus X term. So what we're looking at here then is, let's say we want to shrink a plume. So we have a plume that's 1,000 meters long. We want to shrink it by 50% so it's 500 meters long. How much mass do we have to get out of the source in order to do that? Well, it actually winds up depending a lot on what the source strength concentration is relative to how you define the plume. So that ratio that we talked about on sort of the slot machine graphic before. In other words, if your plume is defined by 5 parts per billion and your source is 500, then you know that's a ratio of 1 over 100. If that is the case, if you want to shrink the plume length in half, you've got to get out 90% of the source. So that's coming from all from this equation here. So you'll see that as that ratio between how you define the plume and what's in the source becomes larger, the amount that you'd have to get out to shrink that contour becomes higher and higher. And it becomes pretty extreme when you start looking at shrinking the plume by, like, say, 80%. In that case, essentially, you'd have to get all of the source out in order to do that, depending on the ratio of those concentrations.
Yeah, Ron, this is Brian. I think that one of the most important things is this really emphasizes the reaction of the system to the amount of concentration reduction that is needed. And it's the reason why, for example, the 5 ppb contour line responds less strongly to a source remediation than the 100 or the 200 or 500 ppb contour line.
Yep, that's right. Now, keep in mind that this is the simplest possible equation, and it ignored time-dependent effects, and there are other benefits to source remediation that this doesn't account for. For example, the life of the source would be shorter. So, you know, if you make the source life 10 times shorter, then, you know, this kind of steady-state approach isn't going to really apply at late times. But to a first approximation, this kind of shows why we emphasize that ratio of the concentration so much. So just to work through kind of a calculator exercise with that equation, let's say we had a case where the pore velocity is 60 meters per year, so a couple hundred feet per year. The decay rate is 0.14 per year. That's a half-life of about 5 years. We have a source concentration of 50,000 micrograms per liter or 50 milligrams per liter, and we're defining the plume by 5 micrograms per liter. So that's a ratio of 10,000, so it's one of the more extreme cases. If we plug in those numbers and calculate the steady state plume length without remediation, it's almost 4,000 meters, so like 2.5 miles. So what would that look like if we remove 90% of the source mass and drop this C0 down to 5,000? Well, when you plug in the numbers into that equation, it only shrinks by about a fourth or so. So that outer contour, that 5 parts per billion contour, only moves back to 3,000 meters. So while the plume would have 10% of the mass it had before, in terms of that low contour of 5 parts per billion, it doesn't move that much. And again, like Brian said, the other contours would move relatively more, like the 500 contour would move quite a bit more. Now, another thing you could do with that little equation is to alter the plume decay rate. So you would do that by just changing the lambda in that equation, and that would assume that you're doing plume treatment over the entire plume forever, essentially. But let's look at what happens if we increase that plume decay rate by a factor of 3 from what it was. So we started off with the no remediation case at steady state. It's about 4,000 meters. We take out 90% of the source, it stabilizes at about 3,000 meters. If we were to also triple the plume decay rate, well, now it's about 1,000 meters. So in that case, that combination reduces the plume length by about 3/4. But you have to remember that this is all steady state, so it implies that everything that's been done is permanent here.
Right, and Ron, as we've seen, this doesn't account for maybe the stuff that's already out in the plume continuing to move down gradient. We'll see some of that. And the other things we'll explore as we get into next week is 90% is a fairly reasonable source removal fraction, and a lot of technologies are doing better than that. So they're getting 95, 98, 99%. So we'll look at what happens when we get even better source removal than that. And then we'll look at what the ramifications are in terms of how much and how long plume remediation is going to be needed.
And then for now, I think we're going to go to our example. We're going to get set up for a hands-on computer exercise. So we'll talk about a PCE spill. We're going to look at two different remediation schemes with RemClor, really focusing on the vinyl chloride plume. Some of the things we'll do is we'll look at the source zone and take out 90% of the PCD sample that's present now in 2009. Also, we'll look at plume remediation, setting up maybe two different zones, an enhanced reductive dechlorination zone. That's going to be an anaerobic zone, adding molasses or lactate somewhere, something like that between 0 and 400 meters. And then an enhanced aerobic degradation zone a little farther out from 400 to 700 meters, and doing this for this 20-year period, 2009 to 2029. Just a couple notes. This is a pretty difficult site, so there's some challenges in trying to get some good plume response and get the situation improved, but we'll look at these different options. And the model will tell you, sort of guide you to which potential alternatives will work best. Second is, although this is a RemClor example, a lot of the same concepts can be applied to RemFuel type runs. How does the plume respond to source remediation? RemFuel will do that. Different reaction zones, RemFuel will do that as well. Mm-hmm. Comment? Okay, we'll keep going. And so this is our example. I've got two more slides. Sort of setting up the layout here. We've got the information from TechPlot showing in 2009 what these plumes look like. We've got four different panels for PCE, which is the parent compound. And this was released in 1979, and 1,620 kilograms were released. This is about 300 gallons of PCE that went to the ground, about six drums. And then looking at these different panels, we can see TCE, cis-DCE, and then vinyl chloride, all in 2009 that have emerged and developed. Some of the notes here is that we have about 57% of the PCD sample still remains in the source zone after this 30-year period from 1979 to 2009. The rest of it's gone down in the plume. Some of it's biodegraded, but we have both mass in the plume and in the source. We have these plume reactions, as you can see in the four panels, the daughter products being generated, TCE, then cis-DC, then vinyl chloride. As we look at this, we can also note that the vinyl chloride plume seems to be a little bit longer. Some of the daughters are longer than the parent. And so we do have this conversion of these chemicals biologically from the parents to the daughters. And now we have this vinyl chloride plume roughly, say, 500 meters long by 100 meters wide. And if you think about this, that's a fairly large area, maybe about 12 acres. And if you're looking at putting in wells to do some sort of injections and you put 30-foot spacings in, that's several hundred wells that you put in that zone to try to make something happen in here. So that's our setup of this. So I think the last key point is the plume is growing, and that's certainly important information for us trying to manage this plume and thinking about it. So with that setup, let me do one more slide that set the stage for the in-class example. And then Brian's going to take it over and start looking at how this plume works and what does RemClor say about it. So on this one, we just got the slot machine type picture once again. And with this, we've got, remember, these are three different columns, and each one is separate. Now, where is the bulk of the contaminant mass is this first key question that we ask when we're starting to think about strategies, thinking about how we want to run RemClor, RemFuel. In this case, the mass is partially in the source zone, partially in the dissolved plume. We have 57% of that original release that's still in the source. So we're really thinking in the terms of these slot machine type things, we are in the middle bar right there. Second column, what's the nature of the plume over time? We've got information here that particularly these daughter products, they're still growing. And that's important to know in terms of the plume management that we're going to do, the remediation we're going to do, the cleanup that we're going to attempt here. Third is we're going to look at how much concentration reduction is needed. And so here a factor of 10,000 to get this particular site to MCLs. So we're going to be doing a lot with this particular case study. It's a more difficult site, but we're trying to illustrate some of the different things that RemClor and RemFuel can do in terms of the source, removing mass, different reaction zones, the whole thing. And so with that, we'll go to Brian, and we'll do this hands-on computer exercise. So Brian, I think you're going to take it from here. Is that correct?
That's right, and actually before I change or take over, I will keep talking for a minute on this. So Ron selected this case to be specifically very difficult. Did you want to comment on that, Ron?
Yeah, I made this case up back when I first developed this code, and I thought my thinking was I would make a difficult case and then figure out clever ways that it could be cleaned up. And it turns out it really is difficult, and using reasonable combinations of parameters, it is extremely hard to deal with. So I just want to say that up front. It's perhaps not a worst-case scenario, but it's in that direction.
Yeah, so the kinds of things that make this difficult are you have a low solubility, a large mass of a low solubility contaminant. So it takes a long time for the source to dissipate. A significant period of time has elapsed, and the groundwater flow has carried a lot of the contaminant out into the plume. That's why it's still growing. And you have a standard that is far below the concentration coming off of the source. So it's kind of a worst case in those sets. Ron selected from the literature kind of the low end of biological degradation rates, although I have to tell you I've seen significantly lower in the real world. So in some ways it's not the worst case, but it's certainly a challenging case. And so what we're going to do is we're going to build the rest of today, and then we'll keep trying to fix this. So as a group, we'll come up with a solution for this problem by the end of next week. But these are built into the REMCOR model as tutorial 6, 7, and 8. And I'm going to switch over to my screen now. And so what...
Just a reminder, as you're switching over, when we get to the model runs, if you're having problems viewing everything, now would be the time to go ahead and switch to that full screen mode. And again, it's a full screen button. Doesn't do it. It's a toggle switch. You just click the full screen. It appears in the upper right corner of the share window. If you want to turn it off, just click full screen again. If that's still not good enough, there are two other square icons to the right. And the rightmost one of the two of them will actually allow you to zoom in even further to look at all the font that's being displayed.
And so, as I said, this is tutorial 6, 7, and 8. 6 is the natural attenuation scenario. 7 is the source remediation, 90% source remediation. And 8 is a theoretical treatment that Ron came up with, kind of a pretty aggressive combined remedy that does a pretty good job of doing a cleanup at this site, but still takes a while to achieve reasonable goals and to achieve cleanup. Ron asked that I run this. I think the goal is it's kind of like the state fair where they're demonstrating the knives, and if like the guy who like demonstrates the knives makes it look really easy, so you think, man, that looks really good, and you get it home, and it's like, man, I can't do that. So I think Ron wanted someone else to run the model so you can see that other people besides Ron can run it. So I'm going to be leading us through basically tutorials 6 and 7. And then Ron's going to take over for 8 and kind of explain his thinking of the combined remedy. So I'm going to switch over to REMCOR in a second. But basically tutorial 6 is what happens if no action is taken. We'll look at that and kind of review the REMCOR setup and how it's all put together. Then we'll look at Tutorial 7 about source remediation. Will it meet site goals? And Tutorial 7 uses 90%. I'll go ahead and do that, and then I'll put in 99%. So we'll see how that works as well and show you that it's pretty easy to do these what-if questions when you're in this model. And then Ron's going to take over after a question period, and we'll have the kind of full remediation. So I'm going to switch over to REMCOR. And I went ahead and loaded it up, but basically you would start the program up like normal. So if you don't have you need to have administrator privileges on your computer, and you would right-click and say run as administrator. And I will point out that I was doing it that way, and every time I ran REMCOR, because I'm at a federal facility, I had to call the help desk and get temporary administrator privileges, which they would grant me for a day at a time. So when I was getting ready for this workshop, I called him and told him I was going to need administrator privileges. And the guy talked to me, and he said, oh, well, I can give that to you for that program. So for you who are at federal facilities who need to get administrator privileges, the help desk took control of my computer for a minute and gave me permanent administrator privileges for this program. So I can just double-click it now and start it up. So that's just kind of a trick for those of you who are at a site where you don't have administrator privileges. Your IT people are likely to be able to grant you administrator privileges that will work until you get rid of your computer. So basically, we're going to look at Tutorial 6, which is already in here. I'm going to double-click it. And once again, if you can't see this in the normal window, click the full screen button. And everyone has been able to see it really well with the full screen button. And the full screen button is a toggle, so it still says full screen, but if you click it again, it goes back to the sheet. Now let me review the sections. This is the input information that Chuck summarized. So we have the 1,620 kilograms. We have the high concentrations, the 100,000 ppb concentrations here. It's in grams per liter. This is the source dimensions for this problem. And you can see this is the natural attenuation case. So this is the source parameters, the source dimensions, the remediation. There's no remediation in this model right now. So this is the natural attenuation case. So this is kind of the transport parameters. So this is the sigmas that we looked at down here. And then this has to do with what's being calculated. And right now we're only going to calculate a centerline concentration. If you wanted to do the contour maps like Ron was showing, you would put in, for example, a Y direction. And just for your information, this is the number of intervals and the min and the max. And a lot of people, the first time they go in, they put in maybe 20 or 30 intervals, and they go from 0 to like 50 or something like that. The center line is 0 in the X, Y, and Z direction, so you only get half the plume when you go to make your contour map in Surfer or TechPlot or whatever brand kind of contouring software that you use. I'll briefly talk about this, and Ron's going to talk about it more, but if you want to look at cancer risk using traditional assumptions that are built into kind of the EPA guidance documents, this is where you put in the oral and inhalation cancer risk slope factors. Once again, Ron will talk about it, but you can see that these are populated in this particular run, and Ron will give the output of that. And then up here, you can see that we have the decay coefficients, the lambdas, for each of the zones, for each time period, for each space in the space-time continuum for each component. So you can see that the assumed degradation coefficient for PCE is 0.4 per year, okay? You have to remember, when we go into do remediation, you're going to have to change the correct box. So for example, if we have remediation occurring in the near field during this kind of intermediate period, you would change this box. But you also have to remember to change each component. So here's TCE, and it's pre-populated with what are assumed kind of the natural attenuation rates. Here's DCE, it's pre-populated with the natural attenuation rates. And here's vinyl chloride, and it's pre-populated with the natural attenuation rates. And then you have these yield factors. So this is the yield going from PCE to TCE, the yield going from TCE to DCE, and DCE to vinyl chloride here. So those are there. I think a question came up last time. Why did you assume that that half of the vinyl chloride went by, you know, the yield factor assumed half the vinyl chloride went by another pathway? The idea there is that when you get down to vinyl chloride, there become a lot more.
But the DCE to vinyl chloride.
The DCE to vinyl chloride. You get a lot more degradation pathways available to you, and so you can assume maybe that not 100% of the DCE is degrading by that reductive dechlorination pathway. And you would use data on the conditions at your site and the literature to tabulations like the BioChlor and BioScreen manual for chlorinated and hydrocarbons, respectively, to figure out what some of those yields and pathways are. So that's really the setup. To run it, we just hit run. You can see it runs relatively quickly. So we're just doing centerline concentrations, although we are doing 100 stream tubes. And I'm going to click output versus distance. And what you'll come into is kind of a standard graph that we can go through. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to reset this to where it makes sense. And so what, you know, we don't typically care about concentrations that are below a part per billion, so I'm going to make the minimum one here. And I think scientific is a little bit difficult to read in terms of concentration, so I'm going to make this number for that. Leave it as a log scale. And I'm going to say okay on that. And I'm going to get rid of the total because we'll just keep looking at the individuals, the PCE, TCE, DCE, and vinyl chloride. Now, so I don't have to keep doing that. I'm going to save that. I'm going to save the chart. I already have Fred here. I'm going to make this like George or something like that. So it's going to save a format file. So each time I come to this, it'll be the default, and I'll just simply load George in, and then it'll automatically make all those changes. So these are the tricks that you learn when you're running the model over and over again. You can also output these graphs, put them into PowerPoint, and if you don't have a fancy movie-making software, you can, you know, put a graph in for each year and then, you know, do, I guess, low-cost animation by just flipping from one PowerPoint slide to another. So there's all kinds of interesting things you can do. But what I'm going to do is just click over here and then use my down arrow key. And I'm going to run down to 30 years. So this is kind of the going through 28, 29, 30. So this is 30 years. You can see that the PCE is highest near the source. The TCE increases and then decreases, then the DC and vinyl chloride. But you can see that the plume is clearly still expanding at 30 years. If I take this on out, I'm going to go ahead and just scroll all the way to year 100. So we're at 60 now, and we're just kind of scrolling through. You can see the plume just continuing to expand and develop. So this is, once again, a very, very challenging problem. So here we are in year 100. And what you can see is that the vinyl chloride is now the fairly far out, and this is 10 parts per billion. So you have 10 parts per billion at about 1,240 meters. So that's a significant distance out. So that's, you know, three-quarters of a mile or a mile, some distance like that. So you can see that basically with no remediation of either the plume or the source, this is what happens. So what I like to do is go back to the model parameters, and we're going to, do our first remediation action here. We're going to do a source cleanup, and I'm going to go ahead and do this. We could just load tutorial 7, but I'm just going to go ahead and do it here, and I'm going to make the fraction remove 0.9, and I'm going to do it in year 30, and it's going to take me about a year to get it done, so that's year 30 to 31. And that's all it takes to do a source remediation. Now, where do you get those numbers? Where did you get the 0.9? You would run other models or use other screening tools to figure out about how good your source remediation is going to do. And, for example, if you're working with a thermal remediation company, you might send all your data in, and they might be able to do kind of a scoping analysis and say, we think we can get 95 or 98 or 99% of the material out there. If they say they're going to get 99.99% out there, I probably would put in 99 or 99.5 at most. But here we're going to do a 90% remediation. I'm just going to hit go. And then I'm going to look at what happens to the output. So I'm going to go in, I'm going to hit file, and I'm going to hit open chart, and I'm going to load George. And so it'll automatically make the format of my chart to have the changes that I made before. So it got rid of the total line, and it made the Y scale so it's interpretable. So it goes from 1 to 100,000. And so what's happened, if I go down to year 30, it'll be exactly the same. So there's year 30, it's exactly the same. And then look what happens in year 31. I'm going to point at this. So here's our source concentration for PCE, right up where my cursor is. And then in year 31, that's exactly a 90% reduction. So that was the 90% reduction because my gamma equals 1 in this particular example. A 90% reduction in mass leads to a 90% reduction in concentration. So here's the true value of source remediation. What you see is that as you press this through time, the new plume that's developing kind of as a steady state plume is much smaller and much lower concentration. So I think a take-home message here is that, you know, the modeling is actually validating the idea that, you know, source remediation is very valuable and you do it to the extent practicable, and especially now when we can maybe do source remediations that get rid of 90, 95, 97, 98%, you can get some pretty good performance. But you can also see, and Ron will talk about this more in a minute, the plume that had already exited the source is really not grossly impacted by the source remediation. It has to be carried down gradient. So if I take this all the way out to year 100, so I'm taking this all the way out to year 100, and DCE is not particularly toxic, but so we're going to look at the vinyl chloride again. What you see is that the vinyl chloride is slightly better. It's slightly smaller, but basically it's right at 10 parts per billion all the way out at 1,240 meters. So the source remediation had a minimal or modest effect on the plume in terms of like the total size that the vinyl chloride got. And just one more quick thing, I'm going to go ahead and make this 99.9%. Just to look at, you know, so let's assume we can go in there and just, you know, let's say we're awesome and we can go in there and get almost all of the contaminant out. I'm going to go ahead and run that. So it's done. I can go down to output versus distance. So you can start get the feeling of how quickly you can run scenarios and really get an idea of what's happening in this site. We're going to load George in here. So that's that. Okay, and I'm going to go ahead and just scroll down to 30 years. So here's 30 years, so that's the same. There's no difference. Nothing's happened yet. Now the next year, we should have removed three orders of magnitude, so it should jump all the way down to here. So you can see that we get that three orders of magnitude reduction in the source, and then as you go down, you see a very strong improvement. Now, very strong means we're still at 30 or 40 or 50 parts per billion at the source with a 99.9% removal. But it shows that if you start getting into these very effective source remediations, possibly in combination with plume remediation, we can have some fairly effective remediation strategies. I'm going to just scroll down and go all the way to year 100 and so we can see what happened. And what you see in year 100 is, you know, slightly better. Now we have what appears to be a disconnected plume, but once again, the vinyl chloride is still washing through, and we have right at 10 parts per billion, right in near the 11 or 1,200 meter range. So once again, this just kind of emphasizes the limitations, even if we have, you know, tremendously successful and tremendously aggressive source remediation. So I'm going to go back to the slides. And so this is just a recap. So this is what happens at 30 years with no action. This is tutorial 6. And this is the same thing that was up on my screen just a second ago. And here it is at year 100. And you can see that what happens is you have this kind of 10 part per billion all the way out to 1,240 meters. And then with source remediation, what happens is we get a new steady state plume developing, but then the rest of the plume that's not affected by source remediation continues to wash through. And one of the things I showed you was the cancer slope risk factor, so I'm going to switch to the next slide, and Ron's going to talk to us a little bit about that.
So last time I described the methodology that's used in the program, it's the standard way of calculating the risk using the cumulative exposure, multiplying that by cancer risk slope factor. These numbers are the ones that are in this example, and I want to caution you. I got these numbers from the state of California back in like 2006 or 2007 when I was putting together this journal paper. So these numbers are not necessarily current, and I would urge you to be very careful about this and go to the appropriate source. Most states have their own approved values for slope factors, or many states do. The EPA has values on the IRIS website. And these values are sometimes different from each other, and they sometimes are reevaluated and change over time. So they have a big impact on the risk, so just be very careful about where you get those from. But you'll see there's two of these. There's the inhalation, and that's related to the risk from breathing the vapors of these chemicals, and then there's the oral slope factor, and that's from the risk of drinking the water. So if you can go to the next slide, Brian. Down at the bottom of the screen there where you see select data set, we've been focusing mostly on concentrations, and that's what we look at most of the time. Sometimes we look at mass discharge, but another option on Remclor is to look at this cancer risk factor. And it produces a graph that's similar to the ones you've been seeing, but the units now on the y-axis are units of risk. It's the chance over a lifetime of getting a cancer that wouldn't have occurred had the exposure not happened. And so 10 to the minus 3 means a 1 in 1,000 chance, and 10 to the minus 6 means a 1 in a million chance on that axis. And remember that the exposure period goes backwards for 30 years. So if you're looking at a time here of 30 years, that means that a person at each of these locations was exposed for the previous 30 years. And again, it's for water coming from a well into a house. The person is drinking 2 liters a day. They're showering in it. It's going through the dishwasher, but there's no direct vapor intrusion through the vadosome. I think the next slide shows the risk profile at 100 years. So this would be an exposure from year 70 to year 100, and these are at different locations along the plume. And you can see the individual risks from the different components, the vinyl chloride dominating the risk here because of its high slope factor, but also some risk being posed by the TCE and the PCE. And you'll notice in this calculation there's no risk from the DCE because it's not considered a carcinogen, or at least at the time when I did this simulation it wasn't, and I believe it's still not. So it works, the risk calculation kind of works in the same way here as the other graphs that you can look at.
And I think this shows a fairly broad exposure potential for numbers above 10 to the minus 4th, right, Ron?
Well, I think ideally you would want to see the numbers below 10 to the minus 6.
Right.
That's roughly how MCLs are established. So right. 10 to the minus 4 would be considered fairly high.
Right, and then even 10 to the minus 4, you have this whole area between 100 and roughly 1,000 or a little more meters that are above even 10 to the minus 4.
Yep.
Right. So what we're going to do is we've looked at DNAPL source remediation alone, and then Ron's going to look at plume remediation. So we're going to set up an enhanced reductive dechlorination zone. And this was an attempt to answer the difficult problems that we're dealing with here, this kind of low, long-term source with a lot of mass in it, with a low solubility contaminant, relatively rapid groundwater flow, and moderately slow degradation. So one of the things that Ron thought would be helpful in a remediation is to really speed up the lambdas out in the plume, and then recognizing that once you have degraded the parents down, that aerobic processes may be able to polish, and so there's like an aerobic degradation zone from 400 to 700, and this is just a hypothetical example that we're going to look at. So I'm trying to look at where we are here. And so we're going to we've simulated the source remediation. I've gone ahead and done this. And so this is just an example from when I was running Remclor a second ago. So what you see here is the 0.9 in the fraction removed in the years 30 to 31. And then this is the 2D contours of the centerline concentrations that I showed. And what you see with the PCE spill, we had source remediation. We removed 90% of that in 2009. And rather than looking at all the different compounds, we're going to use vinyl chloride, which is the most long-lived and the widest, the largest plume. So we're going to compare just the effect on the vinyl chloride plume for the rest of the day here. But you can imagine the associated PCE, TCE, and DCE plumes as well. So the vinyl chloride plume in 2009, this is at the moment of source remediation, looks like this. What you can see is 20 years later, the impact of the source remediation is being shown as this much narrower plume and kind of a disconnected vinyl chloride plume continues to wash down through. And then in 2039, what you have is additional kind of flow has gone by, and in 2079, additional kind of flow has gone by. And if you did the no action case, what you would see is that in 2029, from kind of this point on down, the plumes are very similar because the source remediation has not had a chance to, in essence, impact that point. It's flowing behind this position. Ron, did you want to add anything on this slide?
Well, if you look at that bottom plot, you see that little green zone there. That's that 10 parts per billion that we saw before. And if we had done no source remediation, then we'd have a high concentration extending back from that to the source. So really, the source remediation has helped the back part of the plume rather than the front part of the plume.
Right, and this is one of the things we talk about next week is, you know, setting metrics for different parts of remediation. And so it becomes difficult to think about setting a metric of, for example, affecting the distal 5 part per billion line with a source remediation because of this very effect here. So one of the things we explore next week is, you know, what can we set so that we can declare some of these source remediations successful, recognizing they need to be coupled with plume remediation.
I would also add that, you know, that little derivation I did about 20 or 30 minutes ago where it was steady state, that ignored the effect of time. On this one, you really can see the effect of time. We've reduced that source by a factor of 10, but even after 70 years, it still hasn't washed through the end of the plume. So, you know, in a lot of cases, you can't neglect that time derivative, and this is a good example of that.
Right. And I think, did you have anything else on this, Ron?
No, I think it's a good time to break for questions, probably.
Okay, sounds good. So, Jean,
okay.
I'm sure a lot of things have come in.
Yes, we've got a couple of questions that are in the queue. But before I turn to those, if you haven't typed up a comment or question, you can still do so using that Q&A pod in the lower right corner. If you're having problems actually typing into the tiny little line, you can always type up your questions or comments in another program, another text editing program, and actually use your copy and paste or Control C and Control V and actually paste the full text into that single little line if you're having any problems. So I'm going to start first and see if anybody on the phone lines has a question while we let some more queue up online. If you're on the telephone lines and have a question, please feel free to take yourself off of mute and ask your question. It's #6 to unmute your phone. You may also need to use your own local mute button if you hit that too by accident. And we'd ask that you either identify yourself or organization before asking your question. Okay, we'll check back in with the phone line participants, but we do have a few that have already been submitted electronically. And our first one comes from Christine, who asks, what is the title of the, quote, scenarios document mentioned in the discussion on metals?
Yeah, this is Brian. I saw that question appear in the queue, so I pulled it up. I'm going to send that to Jean so that she can post it on the resources page or whatever it's called, but this is the cover of it right here, and what you see, it's a scenarios approach for attenuation-based remedies for inorganic and radionuclide contaminants. Can you see that, Jean? Is my screen still up?
Yep, I can see it.
Okay, I will send this PDF to Jean, and she can put it on there. It's available online from the Office of Science and Technology Information from DOE, but I think it'll be easier if it's just on the resources page, and I'll send it to Jean.
Indeed.
Right, and you also just go to a Google search, just type in the word scenarios and then the word inorganic, and I think this thing shows up on the top.
Well, what about Bing? Does it show up on Bing?
Probably Bing. I'm not sure. You'd have to maybe go down a couple before it shows up on Bing.
We also had another participant who was able to locate the groundwater validation paper that you had been mentioning, and they've shared a free PDF copy of that particular article as well, and we'll get that posted on Quillen. So we'll share that with everyone shortly. Our next question comes in from David, who asks, in regard to slide number 13, it doesn't seem to me that the plume length is a key factor. Rather, time to reach sea is more important to the public. And perhaps you can comment on that observation.
Yeah, this is Brian. I think that's a really valid comment. That thought experiment was really kind of, in some ways, it's the best case scenario, because you're assuming that the plume has had time to reach its new steady state, and you're not accounting for that washout. In some cases, in some ways, it's a worst case scenario, because you basically are ignoring dispersion and some other things. The goal is really to show that it's this relationship ratio between the driving force, the flow, and the degrading force, the lambda, that control how big a steady state plume get, and then kind of just calibrate ourselves. Are we talking about 10 meters, 100 meters, 1,000 meters? And that helps us to kind of get a beginning clue as to how aggressive we're going to need to be with our different remediations.
Okay, great. Our next question comes in from William, who asks, can we show information before the center line, for example, entering a negative for the y-axis?
Well, the y-axis is perpendicular to flow, so as you're going in the direction of flow, you're on the left-hand side or the right-hand side. And then the x equals zero is the source boundary, so the solution starts just at x equals zero. So we can't really go upstream. We can see what's coming out of the source. You could put in a value of like 0.01 meters for x, and you would see the source concentration.
Right, and I think the caution there is, I think that the solution is actually undefined at zero.
It is.
And not valid at less than zero. For contouring purposes, if you wanted to put a zero in, you know, you could output the data and you could put zeros in for a contouring program. But you can't even put zero in as your first point. You have to put some small value in.
Okay, excellent. Let's go ahead to David's next question, who asks, given the large amount of time to reach sea, shouldn't this mean we need to focus on controlling risk and less on the remediation?
I think that's a great question, and we'll talk about it a lot next week.
Okay, great. And our next question in the online queue from Ahad asks, are the stream tubes three-dimensional? If so, how are they distributed relative to the horizontal and vertical axes?
Well, in a general sense, they're three-dimensional, and by that I mean that the total cross-sectional area is assumed to feed into those 100 stream tubes, and they have an equal size. But what comes through the stream tubes is then averaged every distance. So it's sort of the stream tubes are used to get the dispersion and to, you know, to pull the water out different distances, but then it's averaged to get an overall dispersed solution. So that's why the answer is not divided up in space like that.
But Ron, isn't it true that you can, assuming uniform flow conditions and that any vertical transport down is from dispersion, you can get an answer at any x, y, and z?
Yeah, it is a three-dimensional solution. But in other words, the stream tubes aren't assigned a specific position on that cross-sectional plane coming through the source. It's divided up into a number of stream tubes, and then they're given a velocity from that normal distribution, and then you calculate how far the contaminants would have moved in each stream tube, and then at each x distance would go through and slice that set of stream tubes and average the concentration, and we say, okay, that's what it is at that x location.
Right, and then you overlay the transverse dispersion.
That's right, in vertical.
That's right. So the stream tubes are primarily for the longitudinal dispersion.
That's right. That's exactly what they're for, yeah.
Right. So it's kind of like the escalator where the hand is going slower than the feet, you know.
And you know, the limit of this would be to have one stream tube, and what that would mean is that the whole cross-sectional area feeds into one pipe, and that one pipe goes at a constant velocity. And ahead of the front in that pipe, the concentration is zero, and behind it, it's, you know, whatever left the source plus the reactions. So adding more stream tubes, just like having a bundle of pipes that kind of are going at different speeds, but they're averaged to get the answer that you see, they're averaged together at each X location.
Right, and that's where Ron said if there's a kind of a if you start seeing zigzags in your output, it means you don't have enough stream tubes. That becomes particularly important for things like simulating permeable reactive barriers that are really small. If you don't have enough stream tubes, what you'll get is like strange behaviors around there because you'll have, you know, a zero. You won't have enough to capture the variation across a short distance like that.
Or if you have a component like in REM fuel, if you have a component like MTBE that's washing out really quickly, if you don't have enough stream tubes, that little pod that gets washed out will be kind of discontinuous. But the cure for that is to add more stream tubes.
Okay. Well, that's the end of the online questions that I have in the queue at the moment. So I'm going to go ahead and check one more time to see if anybody on the phone line has a question or comment before we continue on. Remember, it's #6 to locally unmute. You may also need to turn off your own mute button if you use that. And then feel free to ask a question or make a comment. Okay, gentlemen, I think we can continue on.
Okay, well, this is Ron, and we're going to continue on with this PCE example that we've described in some detail now. So we've gone through the natural attenuation case, and Brian went through the source remediation case, and now we want to add in plume remediation, and we're going to use a fairly involved scheme for that. So this is tutorial number 8 that's built in with the program, but you could also go in and modify one of the previous two. So again, to restate this, we're going to set up kind of a fancy system that works off the kind of unique degradation properties of this chain. We're going to have an enhanced reductive dechlorination from the source zone extending down gradient 400 meters. And the idea there is that we might be injecting something like molasses or lactate to drive the system into reducing conditions to degrade the PCE and the TCE primarily. So we model that by increasing those rates in that zone in distance and over this time period. We increase the rate from the background level of 0.4 for PCE up to 1.4 per year. And we'll increase the TCE rate from 0.15 to 1.5 per year, so quite a large increase. But then we're going to assume that the DCE is not going to respond very well in that environment to reductive dechlorination. Now, it may or may not, and it depends on the site. But in this example, we're assuming that the DCE, that this process, in other words, is stalling at DCE here. So we're only just increasing that decay rate slightly. And we're assuming that the vinyl chloride doesn't degrade at all or doesn't increase at all in this environment from the enhanced reductive dechlorination. And again, it would depend on your site. But at this site, it's really working well on the PC and the TC, but the reductive dechlorination is not working very well on the DC and the vinyl chloride. So one possible solution to that would be to set up an additional zone down gradient of that anaerobic zone where you try to create aerobic conditions through perhaps air sparging or some oxygen injection or some, you know, some action to change the geochemistry. And the goal of that in this case is to degrade the DCE and the vinyl chloride. So again, you have to use your judgment and understanding of the site to come up with these rates, but the model will accept whatever you give it. But here, then, we're assuming that in this enhanced aerobic degradation zone that we greatly enhance the DCE decay rate, so it goes from 0.1 to 3.5 per year, and we're greatly increasing the vinyl chloride rate from 0.2 to 3.5 per year. But any PCE or TCE you get into there just decay at their background levels. So in these two zones, the mechanisms are assumed to be quite different, but they're mathematically reflected in these first-order rates, and that's kind of the key point that I was trying to make here. So schematically, on the space or the distance-time diagram, this is what it looks like. Our source release occurred in 1979 at zero. Over the first 400 meters, we want to have this first zone, and we want to start it in 2009 and run it for 30 years. So we'll have the conditions that reflect the anaerobic degradation in that box. And then between 400 and 700, we want to have the aerobic degradation conditions, and again, the same time period, that 30-year period. And then before that time, we just have the natural attenuation conditions. Beyond 700 meters, we have those natural background attenuation levels. And then after the year 2029, we also have that background levels. So these nine boxes, again, give you quite a bit of flexibility, and you can alter any of those four compounds in any of these boxes. So I'm going to switch to the program, but this is what tutorial 8 looks like. So open REMCore, shrink this. If you have trouble seeing this, remember to maximize your screen. If I make this bigger, it just stretches it in a funny way. It doesn't make these characters any bigger. So here's tutorial 8, and it's already set up for this problem. So if we go back to the one that Brian did just a little while ago, we have the same source conditions, the same source dimensions. Here's the 90% source remediation from year 30 to 31. So that would correspond to 2009 to 2010. But now we've put the plume remediation in. So here these numbers all become very important. So here's the first division at 400 meters. Here's the second division at 700 meters. Here's the time. So at year 30, we're going to switch things, and that corresponds to 2009 in this scenario. And we're going to run those conditions for 20 years up until year 50. So for component 1, which is PCEA, increase that rate here from 0.4 to 1.4, and then the others stay the same. So the PCE is degradation is enhanced in that first zone, but not in the second zone, not in the aerobic zone. If we look at the TCE, that degradation is greatly enhanced in that first zone, but again, it's not enhanced in the second zone. If we go to the DCE, well, the rate has increased slightly in that first zone, but then it's greatly enhanced in the second zone downstream over that time. And then if we look at the vinyl chloride, no change in that first zone, so it's really stalling at DCE and vinyl chloride in that first zone, but in that second aerobic zone, we get a very effective treatment of it.
So, Ron, this is Brian. Let me just break in briefly. There's no absolute requirement. You didn't have to start your plume remediation at year 30 that happened to correspond with the source. Those can be totally separate. So you can do a source remediation in year 30 and then start plume remediation, you know, at any point in time. And the second thing here is I think when you first wrote this in Fortran, you know, this is a accounting nightmare to when you first gave it to your students to use in the class, because you have to remember and keep track of all these things. And I think this is what the EPA ADA folks, when they built the interface, really that was a major step function to be able to do this in this graphical format for zone 1, 2, and 3 with the different components, and the same in REM fuel. So I guess I think it's pretty neat. You still do have to remember to change all those parameters. You know, don't forget to change components 2, 3, and 4 when you're looking at remediation.
Yeah, those are both good points. So these time periods have nothing to do with these time periods. They can be before or after or any time. And in a minute, I'll show you what the input file for this looks like. But, yeah, before having this nice interface that the EPA Cosmos guys developed, it was pretty tedious to get this matrix done correctly. It's much more foolproof now, I'd say, from a making mistakes standpoint. So that's how we get everything in here. This one is set up to make a contour plot, so it's going to run a little more slowly. But we'll run it. Still pretty fast.
Man, your computer's really fast. You ran that as fast as mine did the 1D.
Yeah. But since Brian mentioned the old Fortran, I can't resist showing you what that looks like. If we look at the input file for that, you have to get in all these numbers. So this is the Fortran input file that the program reads. So the RemCore is producing this file, and then the Fortran's reading it and then spitting out the numbers, and the RemCore's interpreting those. But you have to get in all these rates, see, all these rates for all these components, and it's really tricky to remember which one's which when it's in this text format like this. So that's what Brian was saying about being pretty tricky. It's much more foolproof the way it is now. So we hardly ever even look at that now. So we can, again, go to the output here. We have this on 5-year intervals. I think I'll go back and rerun this. I think we had 1-year intervals on the other one.
Yeah, so yours isn't as fast as we thought it was.
Yeah, I cheated and I only had 20 time intervals there, but I'm going to change this and make it just one. So now it's a fair race, right, Brian? A level playing field.
Okay, yeah.
Pretty fast still.
Yeah.
So now on output versus distance, this should look more like the ones Brian had. I'll try to make this look a little nicer by going to 1 and picking a number. And I guess we were not really looking at the total. And I should probably save this. Okay. So, again, you're familiar with this scenario now. We go through the first 30 years. Should look exactly the same as they have, and I believe it does. Now, at year 31, we get that same factor of 10 drop in the PCE, but if you look closely, you'll see some interesting things happening in here. We're getting some drops in these other components, so it makes actually a pretty complicated picture that you have to think about a little bit if I toggle through here, but I'll try to explain what's happening. So our plume remediation starts up here at year 30. So after we get a few years into it, here's 6 years into it, you'll see that when we get into that anaerobic zone, our PCE concentrations are greatly suppressed there, as are our TCE concentrations. But look what's happening to the DC. That's actually being enhanced there. So that dechlorination process is stalling at DC and vinyl chloride. So in that first zone, we're destroying the parents, but we're enhancing creation of the daughters. But then when you look at the second zone, which is beyond, I believe, 400 meters, you see the concentration of the DC in the vinyl chloride plummet. So we're catching those as they come out of that that reductive zone and really getting them effectively in the aerobic zone. At the same time, we had a little bit of TCE that got ahead of us. And when we started this whole plume treatment, it was present in that aerobic zone. Well, we're not really treating that, so that little bit of the TC continues to move down gradient. So you wind up with all these different waves that are responding to these different things, but you can see that what I was talking about with the TC moving out of that zone, and actually it's making some DC, and eventually it'll make some vinyl chloride. So these are the centerline concentrations. And as we get out to 100 years, we see this combined solution has greatly reduced that vinyl chloride. So remember before we had this problem of the vinyl chloride still being about 10 at 1,240 meters? We no longer have that. It's closer to 1 or 2 now. So this combination, it's been pretty effective in reducing by quite a lot the plume concentrations, but same time I'll say that they're not zero, and the risk is not going to be zero, but it is greatly reduced. So I think I'll go back now to the slides. And so this is a contour plot of what we were just doing. So let's look first at the TCE. So here's 2009. This is before we do any remediation. And then here's 2029. So this is at the end. We've done the source remediation in 2009, and then we've been doing plume remediation for 20 years. We've greatly suppressed the TCE plume behind 400 meters. So that's where we had that anaerobic degradation zone. So we just have a very small plume of TCE back in there. But yet we do have a plume of TCE out ahead, and that was the TCE that was existing ahead of 400 meters that was in that aerobic zone that really never got effectively treated. So that just sort of got away from us, so to speak, in this remediation scenario. If we look in 2039, that's about 10 years after the plume remediation has been turned off. The plume is starting to reestablish itself in response to that weaker source. So we still have some mass in the source zone, so the plume is going to reestablish itself once we turn off the plume remediation. And we still have this little pocket of TCE that had kind of gotten away from us because of our design. If we go out to 2079, this is, I guess, 50 years after the plume remediation is turned off, the TCE plume has regrown somewhat in response to the weaker source. But it's much smaller than it would have been. Now, go ahead.
I was going to say, go back to that one. This raises some logical questions that I'm sure, and this is, once again, what we're going to do next week, but, why wouldn't we just move out the anaerobic treatment a little bit further and catch that TCE? And this is where I think you start cranking in, what's the impact of doing an anaerobic remediation over the, over hundreds or thousands of square meters? Is that water actually usable during that period of time? I mean, there's all kinds of really interesting questions that come up, and I think this is just starting to set the stage for some of those.
If we look at the vinyl chloride, we see a kind of a different pattern. So here's the same set of time periods, but looking at vinyl chloride, which is the final daughter in this decay chain. So after the end of the plume remediation, you see that we've been very effective in stopping the vinyl chloride. We're producing it back in this anaerobic zone, but our aerobic zone that starts right about here is really cutting off the vinyl chloride very effectively. Now, don't forget, though, there's a little pocket of TCE that's out here, and what happens in this next frame, 2039, that little zone of TCE has degraded down and produced a little pod of vinyl chloride here, but not very much, and that goes away in a few more years. And also we see here, we turn off the plume remediation 2029. By 2039, that plume is starting to regrow some, and it's not really being fed by the source that much, but there was a period here where we were enhancing the production of this daughter product, which is why we have these relatively high concentrations in here. But over time, those die out because we stopped that enhancement of the dechlorination. And eventually, we stabilize at this noose shape, which is a few parts per billion. And so it still exists, plume of vinyl chloride, but it's much smaller and much weaker than it was before. And to compare these, this was the case with no remediation, the vinyl chloride plume. So extended out beyond 1,500 meters, had concentrations in the 10 to 100 range, fairly high. If we did just source remediation, we reduced the back end of the plume quite a lot. But if you look at the point from about 1,100 or maybe 1,200 meters on, the plumes look about the same, and the explanation for that is that it takes all those years for that effect to wash downstream if you already have a big plume when you start source remediation. So it's kind of obvious, when you think about it, that it ought to work that way. And then in this scenario where we combine the source and the plume remediation, we get a much smaller plume by then. Now, in terms of the risk, here was the calculation that I showed you before with no action, and this is year 2079, so it's an exposure from 2049 to 2079. And as we pointed out, it's a pretty high risk throughout much of this plume driven by the vinyl chloride. When we include all this source and plume remediation, the risk drops by, in this scenario, at least a factor 10. So near the source, it's almost exactly a factor 10, and that's because the risk is a linear function of the exposure, and the exposure depends on that source concentration. We drop the concentration somewhat higher in the plume from that plume remediation, particularly on the vinyl chloride, so we get larger reductions in the calculated risk out here, maybe as much as 100. So this would be the new profile, and it's hard to say if this would be an acceptable level. It's still some risk in this scenario because there's still some contaminants in the groundwater there. So to kind of sum this up, this case was difficult. We had a persistent source that will last a couple hundred years. The parent compound produces hazardous daughter compounds, and in fact, the most hazardous one is the final daughter, vinyl chloride. We had a very high source concentration, 100,000 parts per billion, and the MCLs are down in the few part per billion range. So that combination of conditions makes this one difficult to deal with. I guess I should also add that we didn't attempt to do anything for 30 years, so the idea is that we didn't discover this plume for a while. You know, if we had gone back in this same scenario and done something in 1980 from the 1979 release, the effect of source remediation would be much different than it is when you do it in 2009 for a 1979 release. So in this case, where we waited a while and the mass got out in the plume, the source remediation alone may not be enough to manage this plume. And the combination of source and plume remediation appears to work a bit better, although not perfect, I would say. So these examples that we've been giving you, they're not intended to really highlight any particular case, but to sort of show you, give you some ideas about how you might want to use these tools at sites to gain insights into them. And just to sum up the capabilities, you can let the plume develop with no remediation, so you can wait any length of time before you do source or plume remediation. That's kind of a key feature. You have these three geochemical zones where you can alter the rates of any of the components. You can remediate parts of the plume and for different lengths of time and for different components in different ways. And in the end, the plume responds to all these different conditions. So the natural attenuation processes, if you're in those time-space zones, any plume remediation that you might do in space and time for the different components, the source decay by flushing, and also you could have an additional decay, and then also the effects of source remediation. So even though we call it a simple model, you can make a fairly complicated scenario, a fairly sophisticated scenario with it, I think. So we're going to wrap up today looking at another question. We've been focusing on kind of the spatial distribution. What if we were standing at one point in space and we wanted to look at time? Well, the REM core is really set up and REM fuel to do these centerline plots, but as you've seen, you can toggle through those, and that's really how you get the time series. You could also take the file output, the comma separated files, and load those into Excel. You'd have to do a small amount of processing, but you could make time series that way. So in other words, if you were looking at a hypothetical observation well on a property line, you could construct a theoretical time series for that location by using the output. So I want to just look at a case of how we would evaluate the time frame. So there are a few things we could do. We could look at how the source concentration changed over time, and the easy way to do that is to look at a small but not zero value of X. So in that bottom box in REMCLOR, you put like 0.01, and then you can see the concentration at that location just outside of the source. The classic way to look at the problem would be the plume concentrations of the different contaminants. You could also look at the discharge, and there would be perhaps some cases where the discharge was a key metric. And you could also look at the lifetime cancer risk, and there are other things as well. But these are the ones that you would get directly from the models. So this last example, we had this centerline plot. These are the different components. Here's the total, and just adding them together, and it grew for 100 years. So just to make up a goal, what if we had a concentration-based goal, and that goal was that the total VOCs couldn't exceed 50 micrograms per liter beyond a distance of 600 meters. Well, if we go back to the no-action scenario and look at that, we'll see that it's not going to meet that goal, the prediction. So 50 micrograms per liter would be 20, 30, 40, 50. It would be right about here. In this simulation, at year 2009, we're already at 50, at close 50 parts per billion, and we're close to that that theoretical boundary there, that 600-meter boundary. Perhaps it's a property line or something. If we run the simulation out, so in other words, you toggle down through, you would see that it's going to greatly exceed that over time. So then we can go and look at our remediation scenario, and here I've drawn in a heavy black line on that 50 parts per billion. So with our remediation scenario, it takes a while to meet that goal, but it looks like at year 54 that we do, because here's 600 meters, and the concentration here beyond it is less than 50. So it looks like we've met the goal. But what you have to remember is that we have these other waves that may still be moving, and we've turned certain things off in the plume remediation. So what actually happens here, this wave crosses the 600-meter line, and so we would have a violation of that condition at that point, and it's actually gone to 100. So if we're looking at a time series, on this day, the concentration is below detection if our detection limit's 1. So we might be pretty happy. The observation well, it's gone to 0 or it's non-detect, and then all of a sudden it jumps up to 100. Well, that's the kind of thing you could get by looking at these time progressions. So if we go further out, finally, after 76 years, we meet that goal. So now that line got moved to the wrong spot. It should be about here. But now our total concentration is maxed out at about 50, and no other wave is going to hit us here. So I think we're going to kind of shift gears now, and Chuck's going to take over. Talk about source decay program.
Yep, so this is Chuck. Thanks, Ron. And basically, the source decay model, we just have one slide about this. This is a tool developed specifically to evaluate remediation time frame under natural attenuation scenarios. And it has these three different modules. It has a first module that's where you can extrapolate existing concentration versus time data at a well or some sort of average concentration data from a certain zone, and then extrapolate this on a semi-log plot, and it tells you that, well, if this trend continues and with these concentrations, you'll hit your remediation goal, let's say it's an MCL, 20 years from now. It also gives you some uncertainty bars on either side. The second module is one where it's a box model, and you can put a certain mass inside the box, a certain number of kilograms, and you talk about the flow through the box, and looks a little bit like REM fuel, REM chlor, except it's only for natural attenuation. You can't pull any mass out. And with this mass balance type approach, then it will help you look at this question of remediation time frame. You can search for this on the GSI webpage, gsi-net.com, and it's a free download. This was originally developed for the Air Force and their environmental program. So just a simple spreadsheet tool to help think about remediation time frame. This is just one of these other tools in here. So with that, let's go to the last part, I think, of the session today. We're going to go to the homework exercise. Again, a voluntary exercise. This is exciting. Homework exercise number 2, impact to a well. And this is a problem that's really coming from the world of mass flux and mass discharge. I think one of the key references out there is this ITRC document that I helped write, with the use and measurement of mass flux and mass discharge, August 2010. And this is on the impact side. How do you use some of these numbers? And so the problem in the homework here is that there's a chlorinated solvent source area, let's say, that's just been discovered or been delineated, and there's been some work done on what is the mass discharge leaving that source zone. Sometimes people call this mass flux, but in our document, the ITRC document, we say this is a mass discharge that's and it's 0.2 grams per day of TCE. You also know that this source zone is in a capture zone of a pumping well. And the question is it doing some simple calculations, is it possible that this could cause an unacceptable risk to the users of the pumped groundwater? I'll just quickly go over some of the different input data. Mass discharge, again, some people call this mass flux. We call it mass discharge. 0.2 grams per day. Let's see, that came out of, an effort where somebody put a transect down gradient of that source zone and came up with that number. And we call this, in one of some other work we did, a MAG-4 plume. Brian, you want to explain a little bit about the plume magnitude classification system paper we wrote?
Yeah, this is a paper that Chuck and Shala and Dave Adamson and I put together for groundwater. But it really grew out of conversations, and we were talking to some of the folks that were working on mass discharge, Murray Einerson and others, for example. And they made the statement, you know, I'm really starting to get a understanding in my gut of, like, you know, what it means to be like a 10 gram per day plume versus a 100 gram per day plume. And it started us thinking that in many disciplines there are these magnitude scales, like in earthquakes or hurricanes and things like that. And so this was really our attempt to try to put a scale together so that people could start coming up with a common vernacular for basically the kind of potential impact of plumes. And it's really just a thought experiment. What we're doing today is really we're going to introduce this flux during the homework, but it's just one of the tools that's out there to start thinking about how to develop technically based responsive metrics for cleanup.
And in the case of earthquakes, you've got these different Richter scale that goes up to these different size earthquakes, you know, 8 or 9. In this case, the plume magnitude system, there are 10 different categories where 10 is something that's greater than 100,000 grams per day, and that's you think about that as a mega plume. On the other hand, a mag 1 plume is something with, I think it's 0.001 grams per day. We call that, a plume that's in a pissant silt unit. Some people might refer to that. Not much flow, very low concentration.
And maybe a dry cleaner or something like that.
Yeah, it was a pretty small site, and not much flow, not much mass discharge. This particular example, 0.2 grams per day, it's a MAG-4 plume out of this 10 scale. Pumping rate of the well, 1 million liters per day, MCL, of course, 5 micrograms per liter. And what your job is, if you choose to accept this assignment, is to put the numbers into this highly complicated box system. Probably the hardest part of the homework is going through your desk and trying to find your calculator, calculate these things out, and then you have a conversion problem going from grams per liter to micrograms per liter multiplied by 1 million, and write the numbers in the box. And then at the very end, we have these three questions. The first one is, what is the answer in the box? And then the next two are more subjective. There's no real right or wrong answer on this, but in our classes, we bring it open for discussion. Brian, Ron, you want to add anything to this, or are we ready to wrap this up?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, once again, what we're going to try to do next week is we'll try to populate some polls so that if you come up with different topics that are uncertainties or ways that this could be used, we're going to start off with some polls, and we'll use polls all during next week or little surveys that you'll be able to answer in real time. And this is something Gene got us excited about. It's a capability of Adobe Connect. And we'll have two different kinds of polls, ones that have like a single answer and ones that, you know, check all the boxes that apply. And we'll try to be good in putting the polls together so that they capture some of the things that you might want to say. And, of course, if we miss something, you can enter them into the comment section. But as Chuck said, there's no right answer on these. It's really just kind of the beginning of our joint exploration and collaboration on what we're going to do next week.
Okay, I think we then turn this over back to Jean, and we'll have some more questions from the group.
Yes, you do. And so I'm going to go ahead and take some of the questions that have been submitted online. You can keep typing them up if you like, and we'll, of course, take a minute or so as well to check with our phone line participants. So we have come to that 3 p.m. end time, but I think we're going to stay just a few minutes over to get to a few of the questions we have in the queue. So the first question comes in from Mark, who asks us, if 79.5% of PCE degrades to TCE, its yield from a REMCOR, what happens to the other 30% plus or minus?
Well, I'll answer that. This is Ron. The REMCOR uses mass units, so the molecular weight drops as you strip the chlorines off. So we're actually, in that case, getting 100% conversion of the PC to TC, but the molecular weight drops. So that's the reason for the change.
Right. If we were using molar concentrations, then the yield would be 1.
Yeah, so good question. And the answer is that that's the ratio of the masses, not the moles. And so you have to really put in the ratio of the molecular weight if you want to do 100% conversion, which is what the 79.5% is.
Okay. Just in time to put everybody in the Halloween spirit with the background noise that coming in. I apologize for the chime. The next one is a pretty lengthy comment that came in from John in reference to the ITRC LMAPL class. And he mentions that we discussed the removal of more soluble and volatile constituents in LMAPL to meet the compositional concerns. However, what we are left with after using a, quote, phase change technology are long-chain, low-solubility, low-volatility compounds that do not pose a risk unless they are dug up. Does RemFuel model this loss of specific LMAPL constituents, the benefit of that, and how long the remaining, quote, asphaltic material will remain?
Well, I'd say it can, because you can add these different components in there, and so the ones that are soluble will wash out relatively quickly, and you could add ones if you wanted that were not so soluble, the model would show those remaining there.
And Ron, can't you add just a class of, in essence, relatively insoluble, undifferentiated material that could remain?
Yeah, you could call it like diesel range TPH and give it, you know, some kind of average property in terms of solubility, and it would be a fairly low solubility. And what you would see is that that would remain there.
It would remain there and be pretty low risk, right? If this low solubility stuff that's not being flushed out pretty quick, but you could model octane or whatever you want, as long as you had a solubility, and you could compare it to a risk number as long as you had some risk values to do the comparison with.
That's right.
All right. Well, our next question comes in from William, who asks, can REMCOR be used for a PCE plume dissolved in diesel?
Yeah, this is Brian. Let me go ahead and take a crack at that. You can. You would put PCE in as a component, and it would wash out. The caution is that RemFuel wouldn't be capable of tracking the entire chain of daughters because it only has one daughter. And, of course, near a diesel, you would probably have reductive conditions, and you would have a pretty aggressive PCE reduction going on in the near field. So it may be a case of maybe running the two models together or some other scenario to run them. What do you think, Ron?
Well, I think it makes sense to run that in REMCOR probably, and you would use the first down gradient zone, I think, to represent the zone where there's the dissolved diesel components that perhaps make it anaerobic and enhance the degradation of the PCE and TCE.
Right, that sounds good.
You'd have to know, you know, where those zones exist, but I think that would be kind of a classic case where there is some enhancement going on from the co-contaminants.
Okay. Well, I take that back. I've got one more question that came in the online queue, and this one comes in from Steven, who's, again, looking for some more comments on REMFuel and risk. And, you know, exactly how groundwater that's laden with these long chains, aliphatics, is not usable. So I think just, you know, overall a general discussion about risk and the models and how they're handled would really be appreciated.
Yeah, this is Brian. Let me just take a quick crack at that. I think it's a very good comment, and, you know, it's one that, you know, models don't answer questions like that, and particularly screening models like this, so that, you know, if there is concern about long-chain aliphatics in groundwater, then RemCore or RemFuel can't answer, you know, can't address that question. They can just tell you what those things are going to behave like, and then it becomes the role of the regulator and the project team to figure out what the ramifications of that are.
And I think there's been some of this new developments going on. For example, in California, they have now some low-threat guidance that talk about some of these underground storage tank sites where there's been some remediation done, or they pose low risk and are low, they're a low threat. And perhaps some of that thinking is now being evolved into some regulatory programs. And that's just one example I could think of.
Okay, great. Let's go ahead and see if anybody on the phone line has a question or comment. Remember, we have globally muted the lines, so you'll need to hit #6 to unmute and then ask your question or make a comment. Okay, I don't hear anybody on the phone lines. I don't see any more questions in the online queue. So since we're a little bit after our scheduled end time of 3, I think we're going to go ahead and carry on with the final closeout procedures. So before I begin, I'm going to give our presenters a chance to make any final comments that they might have. So let's start with you, Brian. Anything you'd like to say to the audience?
Yeah, thank you guys for coming on. I know this is a tough week with everything going on in the country, and we really appreciate it. We look forward to next week. It's one of the more exciting of the 5 modules, so sorry we kept it till the end, but we had to kind of set things up. And I think Gene will probably comment on it, but it looks like at least 56% of you are excited about next week. So.
Indeed, indeed. And Charles or Chuck, any comments from you?
No, just we're trying out this polling feature in Module 5 next week, and just be patient with us, and it'll be an experiment that we'll all get to participate in, and I'm looking forward to it.
Great, thanks. And Ron, any comments from you?
Thanks, everybody, for attending, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, great. Well, as our presenters have already alluded, I kind of gave everyone a sneak peek of some of the new tools we can use, and one of those is a short little poll that you can see at the bottom of the screen asking if you're going to be excited for Part 5, and if you didn't know, you're the one person who said Part 5 of what? I'm referring to Part 5 of the seminar series, which will take place next Wednesday at the same time, so November 7th at 1 p.m. Eastern. We'll complete the 5th and final installment of our seminar series here looking at practical models for remediation strategies. Again, if you want to take a minute and look at that poll feature at the bottom, this is an example where you could click an answer. You don't have to click submit. Simply pick the circle that is the closest to the answer you'd like to select. We're not going to release anybody's names, but you guys can see how people are voting and how the distribution changes as people pick new answers. So we're going to be using new tools like that next week in the final part, and we will encourage you to plan to be engaged and interactive with our presenters next week. I'm on the 49th slide of our slide deck for today, which is our standard reminder to let you know that there are real people like myself and other professionals here working behind Cluin that are constantly looking for new ways to share information and work with hazardous waste cleanup professionals. So if you haven't visited Cluin Information Network's website at cluin.org, I would encourage you to do so, or you can even find us out on popular professional networking sites like LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter. We'd encourage you to follow us and stay connected. The last slide I had to go over is the very important one, where we get a lot of questions about where can I get a copy of the models, what about that reference or the article you discussed. I'm looking to get confirmation of my participation. Can you give me verification for my training officer? Let's talk about those two things before we close everything out today. First of all, if you're looking for copies of materials that were mentioned, in particular the homework files, or perhaps the groundwater article that was referenced earlier today, We have those resources available on the seminar resource page, which is available on the seminar homepage. There's a link that says resources. You'll also find the same link in this related URLs pod to the right. You can find it again either on the seminar homepage or go directly there using the exercise and resources link. We're going to continue to post additional resources. I think there are a few other references, for example, links to the Source DK program. We'll make sure are posted up there as well. And those links will remain active from this point forward. So if you need to refer back to it a few days, even a few weeks down the road, you can always come back here and check them out. The other link on slide 50 is a link to our short feedback form. I do read each and every one of them, and I do appreciate everyone who has not only commented on the topic, on the delivery approach, because remember, this usually is a hands-on training class. So trying to divvy it up into modules and deliver it completely online has been a bit of a challenge. So we do appreciate everyone working with us and giving us their thoughts on that, as well as our new tool, Adobe Connect. If you're looking for credits for your participation today, we do not issue certificates, CEUs, or PDHs. However, when we conclude today's seminar, you'll be able to click on the link to the short feedback form and fill that out. As long as your email address is entered properly and you check the box, which is circled on this screen, you can have a confirmation message sent to you for your own records. You may find that if you keep that confirmation message that you did at least provide feedback for the event when it was over, and you have a copy of the slides and your registration email, that may be enough to get credit from your accrediting institution. If you're having difficulty locating those items, you can contact me. We'll try to pull whatever training records we can to at least verify that someone did check in under your name and perhaps submitted feedback. But we'd encourage you to take the extra steps to keep copies of those emails, copies of the slides, as well as copies of the confirmation message. You can also simply print the screen as soon as you fill out the form, because that very same confirmation message is displayed in a web browser window. If you share the line with multiple people, each person can fill out their own form. Even if you all participated under one person's registration, each person can get their own feedback confirmation sent to them for their own record. And yes, if you're one of the lucky ones listening to the archive, you too can still fill out a feedback form and get your own confirmation after the live delivery. That's the end of all the reminders I have for everyone today. We did have, surprisingly, almost 350 people who were able to join us from all over the world. Again, people from over the U.S., international participants from as far away as Australia. We do appreciate everyone who took time out of their busy schedules to participate today. And again, continue to wish the best of luck to everyone who was impacted by Hurricane Sandy. And a final happy Halloween to those of you who made time for us today on October 31st. Again, part five, the final part, will be delivered next Wednesday at the same time. So I look forward to hearing from you or seeing from you